6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision flyby helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the...
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of A Public Affair. My name is Mike Moon, your host for today, as we'll be talking with Ruth Conniff, Molly Stentz, and various other folks taking phone calls talking about the elections last night. I will confess that when I planned this show, I really did expect that it would be more of a victory than it turns out that it has been, and lots of sad faces around the room. 256-2001, 866-899-9678 to join today's program. We'll be talking with Ruth Conniff from the Progressive Magazine, who is joining us today in studio, and Molly Stentz, who was in Milwaukee at the covering the events in the Darling Pash race, or Pash Darling race. So she'll be with us for part of the show just to talk about what happened in Milwaukee and give some thoughts and perspectives. And Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing.
And Molly, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, Mike.
No worries. And as everybody knows, we just the quick version is that we needed three victories last night to flip the Senate majority from Republican to Democrat, and we got two. Now, there's a lot of bright siding out there about how this is really a victory, and, you know, these are like muscles, and the more you use them, the stronger they get. And that's all true, but this is still a loss. And let's not sugarcoat a loss, and let's just talk about what this means and talk about how it happened a little bit, too. Can you give a little bit of a summary last night from Milwaukee?
Sure. Well, two of the Senate races that were fairly predictable. I think a lot of folks that were predicting a win for Kopanky and a win for Hopper. So Kopanky in western Wisconsin and Hopper in the Fond du Lac Oshkosh area. I think most people going into yesterday predicted those ones, those Republicans were going to lose. But
yeah, right.
The two that were most most tightly watched were the Darling Pash race in Milwaukee and the Luther Olson Fred Clark race in the Baraboo Portage area. Mm-hmm. So can't be everywhere at once. Wanted to drive all over the state and visit every district, but that proved to be physically impossible. I didn't have, you know, Air Force One or the governor's SUV or anything. So had to pick my battles and went to northern Milwaukee suburbs where the race was pretty heated between longtime incumbent Alberta Darling, you know, almost a 20-year veteran of the legislature, being challenged by Sandy Patch, nurse and relatively new state representative to the area, ran a strong get-out-the-vote campaign, had folks there stepping for her, everyone from, you know, Senator Chris Larson from Milwaukee to Mark Pocan of Madison to Jan Schakowsky, actually, from Illinois. Congressman Schakowsky drove up from Illinois, brought a bunch of Illinois supporters. There were folks from all over the state and folks from Madison, a bunch of folks there in that district, as well as obviously the residents and voters there in the Glendale area. So it turned out to be another nail biter down to the end. It was the last race to be called. It was a close race, not the closest, but a fairly close race, 54-46 for Darling, which was about what a lot of the Republicans were calling it. They were estimating Darling would win with 52-54%, and that's basically what they'd been saying all night. So, you know, as the returns started to trickle in throughout the night, and the Democrats got two, and then the three went to the Republicans. Everything was on. All eyes were on this race. And I did go to the Darling campaign party as well. And, you know, it was interesting in that it was a much smaller group of people, much more reserved, and you know, frankly, somewhat of a nervous crowd. It definitely wasn't a cavalier victory. I mean, you had You know, you had a number of Republican legislators there. Sensenbrenner was there, Vukmir Voss, you know, a lot of the Republican leadership was there to support her. But it definitely wasn't a sense of, oh, we got this one nailed. It was definitely a bit of a reserved sense of nervousness in that race, which is probably a somewhat new feeling there. Sure. So the PASH campaign, though, and the party was packed with people. I mean, on the order of, I would say, maybe 200 people or so early on in the Darling, and probably upwards of 1,000 at the PASH campaign. A lot more young people, a lot more diversity, a lot more people, you know, from organizations like Planned Parenthood, environmental groups, Democracy for America, a bunch of groups across Milwaukee sending representatives there. So it was much more high energy. I think people had expectations. Most of the media was at the PASH party.
Sure. And pretty high drama if actually it goes PASH's way. It's got a pretty exciting night. And
from all signs, people were looking to that race. But it didn't happen at the end. You know, PASH came out maybe around 11, made what in retrospect was kind of a concession speech. She didn't call it that at the time. You know, she came out and thanked all the supporters, that it was a great night, a great show. She wasn't going to call the race and she was going to go home. But then later on, the campaign did.
Made it clear.
You know, there were reports that she did concede to Darling, and she did. And then issue a statement maybe at almost 1 a.m.
Yeah. Okay. So, Ruth, you've been watching this pretty closely as well. What do you think that are the important takeaways from this?
Well, I mean, I think that you're right that it's silly to call it a victory. I mean, I think, you know, people feel a little chastened and down because the Democrats needed to win 3 seats to retake control of the Senate. However, it's so much like the Kloppenburg race, and I just think the parallels where Molly was, where Kathy Nicklaus came back like a figure from a recurring nightmare
showed
and sat
again
on the vote totals.
Yeah, Wisconsin's own Freddy Krueger. Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. So, I mean, it was really, I was in Madison. I was downtown with the crowds that were watching the Ed Schultz show and at the Majestic Theater watching returns, and talked to some Democratic officials who just weren't willing to say anything because the two possible results were so different that saying something at 10 at night just wasn't necessarily going to be the same thing they'd say at 7 this morning. So, you know, I think the thing to remember, though, is a lot of this is psychological. I mean, in Madison, we think of it as a referendum on Scott Walker. Out in the districts, these are local races. In Washington, the Post is saying this is a referendum on Obama.
I mean, interesting.
You have to get a little perspective about the fact that, you know, what this really is it's a nuts and bolts, difficult effort to overcome massive power on the other side. And it's going to be harder because the Democrats fell 1 seat short of retaking the Senate. And so just like Joanne Kloppenburg turned a lot of red areas of the state blue, and really for a completely unknown lawyer from Madison to run an incumbent Supreme Court justice almost to a draw. Was a tremendous achievement that felt totally dispiriting because we didn't get the actual win, right? Well, it's the same thing here. You know, it was very significant to defeat a couple of Republican legislators in very strongly Republican districts. It was a very clear message. You know, the Republicans, at the end of the day, no matter how much triumphalism you hear, lost 2 seats in the Senate. And so, you know, they are down 2 more seats. They are only holding a majority by 1. A lot of people are hopeful that Dale Schultz will vote with Democrats. I don't know if that's really a reasonable hope. But I do think as far as what the symbolism of this is, it is what you make of it. And the fact is, we live in Wisconsin, and we're going to have to keep fighting because the issues are the same. We're defunding our public schools. We're defunding, you know, basic municipal services and infrastructure in this state. We're handing out tax breaks to huge corporations, and we're really changing fundamentally the nature of our state. And unless we keep on fighting that, you know, what's our option, really? So I think, as much as I agree with you that some of the effort to spin this as a win, as a positive thing, just doesn't square with what the goal was, right?
Yes.
It's still, I think, important to recognize what has been achieved here, and that all those folks who got out and went door to door, really, they, you know,
made
they gained 2 seats, and they gave a couple of very strong Republican incumbents, Luther Olson. You know, there hasn't been a Democrat elected to the Senate from that district since the 1860s.
Yeah.
So the fact that it didn't go Democratic in this election is disappointing to Fred Clark's supporters, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, you know, they made a significant difference there.
They did. And I don't want to be too dour about it, but at the same time, you're right. We're short of the goal.
Yes.
And that's important because the reality is that having a Democratic Senate is a very big part of the machine that we can control. And
that
we
However,
don't.
That was not going to change fundamentally politics in Wisconsin for the next
True.
Several years, right? It, at most, it would be a stop. You know, it would be kind of a firewall. You know, Scott Walker got an awful lot done in an awfully short period of time, right? We already have the mm-hmm. disempowerment of public employee unions. We already have $1 billion in cuts to our public schools. I mean, so it the three seats were not going to reverse the political direction of the state. So I actually think the significance was more psychological.
Okay.
And it was in terms of momentum for the Walker recall.
Right. Yeah.
The Walker recall's going forward. Mm-hmm. You know, psychologically, we can kind of decide what to make of this.
That's
and in
true.
That sense, I think we really should keep our eyes, you know, on the ball, because this was not going to get rid of Walker, and this was not going to get rid of his whole destructive agenda. It was just a step, you know, just a break on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you have the Democrats and the Democratic Party also taking a step back from the Walker recall campaign. Yes, they say it's still on, but the head of the Democratic Party is now saying, well, Democrats are not running the recall. That's on the community. That's on the activists. That's on, you know, the neighborhood groups. We're not going to be the ones responsible for that, which is, you know, and they tried to walk away from the Senate saying, well, we didn't really put anyone up to these recalls, but
sure.
very clearly they did.
Don't
back,
look at us. Right.
They very clearly did back all of these candidates and support them in the recalls. It very much was a Democratic Party, or it became a Democratic Party agenda to win back the Senate. And so now that they have
failed,
lost, and they did not change the course of the Senate, the fact that they're now claiming that they're not going to be out front in front of the Walker recall, I found a bit interesting.
Mm-hmm. We do have a caller waiting to join the program, so we'll go to the phones. Hello, and welcome to A Public Affair.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I have a couple of comments and a question. I would just like to thank the conservative spin artists for the blatant hypocrisy of their alleging that there was a somehow outside money flooding into Wisconsin that was promoting all of these liberal advertisements, specifically the unions, for these Democratic challengers. You know, all of that money that came in from those conservative foundations, if that isn't clearly apparent to the electorate, we've got an electorate that is just deaf to the reality of the political scene in America. You know, there was a lot of outside money that came in for progressives, but there was also a ton of money that came in from the conservative foundations,
that's right.
Grover Norquist and others. You know, how somebody can listen to that and be taken in by it and not see the hypocrisy is astounding to me. I just hope that the voters in successive elections understand what the Walker agenda and what the Neil Dog Republican Assembly and Senate have done to this state.
Sure.
And when they do, hopefully the electorate is bright enough. We've got a democracy with enough educated people that it will work.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, and a big part of that is media. You know, what the public understands about what's going on is has a lot to do with the media, the nature of the media, and the structure of the media, and
yeah.
people's access to good info.
The outside money is a huge factor. There's no question. And I think, you know, I spent this past weekend up north in the Holprin district, where they are just being bombarded with ads, and mm-hmm. voters are really turned off by the negative campaigns on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that does have a distorting effect on the whole process and on sort of how people perceive the issues. So Republicans in the two recall elections against Democratic senators that are coming up next week, their message that they are just hammering and hammering on is that the 14 skipped out of work. They left town. They
right.
didn't do their job. This is a message that in Madison is just ridiculous, mm-hmm. right? Because the 14 are not only heroes mm-hmm. around here, but they didn't go on vacation,
no,
right?
Right.
Whether you liked what they did or not,
it
they were
hardship.
Doing something yep. political. It was a political move, and it was, you know, clearly something that they were doing as representatives of their constituents. That message, though, has really penetrated. And I have to admit, the first time I heard it, I got into an argument with a guy at a Paul Ryan event who was spouting the same message. They walked off the, I don't get paid if I don't do my job. And
right.
I said, that's just ridiculous. I'm here at this Paul Ryan event. I'm not back in the office, but I'm doing my job.
Right.
And I truly feel this guy had never even thought about it that way. Like, it mm-hmm. just is such, it's just the constant repetition of this simple message.
The easy message, yeah.
So that I talked to some people who were Holbrun constituents and plan on voting for him, but said that he made a mistake by leaving town and wow. walking out on his job. But they support him because
walking
he's been there for
job.
Them. Yeah. So that message has really penetrated, and it's done so because the Club for Growth has put tens of millions of dollars into running ads that spread that message. And, you know, people aren't paying really close attention. Then they pick up these few sound bites yep. or, you know, they get completely turned off. I talked to as many people who are not planning to vote in that recall election as I did who were planning to vote. Hmm. And a lot of them had summaries. Like one guy said to me, well, you know, she didn't pay her taxes and he didn't go to work.
Right.
So that's yeah. that's like the summary of the campaign. So, yeah, I mean, I think that outside money and those negative ads have had a distorting and depressing effect on the election. The other thing that I took away from going up north was that I think there's a legitimate criticism of the state Democratic Party for not getting its act together more for this recall election and really putting out a coordinated message about this as a yeah. referendum on Scott Walker.
Yeah.
And however, in the district where Holbrun has a number of supporters who also like Scott Walker, uh-huh. you really get a different picture of what people are voting on and what they're thinking about.
Uh-huh.
And Holbrun, you know, who's been in the legislature for many, many years, has really been, he describes himself as a parochial politician. His issues are hometown issues. He feels mm-hmm. that the northern part of the state is underrepresented. He's one of only two senators who represent half the state. And he's all about the Main Street program, which, you know, helps keep those towns alive. He's about maintaining trails. He's about fighting invasive fish species. These are not issues that the Club for Growth is running ads about, right?
Right.
These are not issues that outside liberal groups are running ads about. This is more really local stuff. So I think talking to those constituents and talking to Holbrun made me feel more how local these races really are and how much we impose this political narrative that's about the big picture, whether uh-huh. it's about Scott Walker or President Obama, on people who are maybe not thinking about it that
sure.
way.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my question for you, because I heard a lot of that in the districts as well. And I felt that a lot of these elections were really referenda on how much constituent service a lot of these incumbents have done over the years. I mean, how much they've connected with people and delivered for people, because a lot of people talked specifically not necessarily so much about the challenger, not so much about Walker, but just how they felt about the candidate. Did the candidate return their phone calls mm-hmm. when they tried to reach them
yeah.
in the spring and winter? You know, did they know the candidate? Did they know, any, you know, have they dealt with them at Little League or at church or, you know, those types of things? And so it did feel really local.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, for the Walker election or recall, should that go forward, are you going to see people splitting on that, feeling that, hey, I like my local guy, he's always done well for me, he lives down the street, I know him, but that Walker guy does uh-huh. not support,
right.
I don't support that extreme agenda. Are they going to make that division?
On the flip side, mm-hmm. I went to the Arborvita Fireman's Picnic where the fire chief, Frank Bauer, told me that he had run Kim Simak, who's a Tea Party candidate running against Holbrun up there, off the premises. He's a Holbrun guy, supports Holbrun. So I started interviewing him, feeling like I knew where he was coming from. No, he said, Holbrun shouldn't have left the district. He always calls him back. He's also the head of the town government there. He says he always gets right back to them and he addresses their needs, as you're saying. But he also supports Scott Walker because he stood up and he did what needed to be done, and they have to balance their town budget. And so the state should balance its budget too. So it is possible to have this completely divided politics. So here is a guy who I'm sure will not vote against Walker in a recall election, but seems to be one of the prominent local official supporting the Democrat who's being recalled by the Republicans up there. So people can have a real mishmash of politics.
Oh, yeah, I've talked to a few people that said, you know, they supported the candidate, Luther Olson, but they wanted to see the Dems take control of the Senate.
Interesting.
You know, they liked their guy, but right. but they
were
they
still
thought,
hoping for a flip.
Yeah, they were wanting divided government.
Well, and for the Luther Olson and the Alberta Darling races, mm-hmm. you're talking about people who have a lot of friends in their districts, have mm-hmm. been in office a long time, mm-hmm. and used to be moderates. Mm-hmm. These are folks who were not right wing Republicans until the Scott Walker era. So Darling sat on the board of Planned Parenthood. You know, Luther Olson was actually the person who voted against some of the more extreme school reform issues, like handing over special ed kids to a voucher program that's going to deprive them of their rights to IEPs. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has a moderate reputation and a moderate demeanor. He's a friendly guy. Mm-hmm. He's a soft-spoken guy. Mm-hmm. Darling, you know, still has that reputation of being a pro-choice Republican, although she has stopped voting that way. So I think there's also, I mean, I think that kind of personal touch and people's long-term relationships is another big factor.
Really carries people through. We do have another caller waiting to join the program, so we'll go to the phones. Hello, and welcome to Public Affair.
Thank you. Just a couple points, and to add on with the comments that were just made in regard to Luther Olson, I saw him interviewed, and he did seem genuinely disgusted by some of the ads that were run, you know, out of, beyond his control by some of these outside groups. That happened to be for him, you know, that were beneficial or, quote, beneficial to his campaign. But I guess the thing that I would add to today's angst, if that's what people are feeling, is that this whole journey since January, it's been a roller coaster ride, up and down. And last night, I guess, had a bit of both. And that I would temper the angst that people may or may not be feeling with the Republican recalls and just kind of remind that we already had one unsuccessful recall against one of the Democratic senators with two more to follow. And I think this is also a part of the big picture because we from the Democratic side, I guess, think that all the emotional upset that this journey has caused is on our side. But it's also a chance for the people and proponents of the Fitzwalker regime to take out some of their frustration on the quote Republicans who flee the state, blah blah blah.
Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, well, thanks for the call. Right, so lots of perspective and different ways to see this, and different ways to interpret the implications moving forward, especially with the Walker recall. Do you see any of the, well, I mean, I guess we all expect that all the outside groups that contributed to the Republicans during the recall will be fully in support of and in our state, on the ground, in our media, influencing the direction of the recall. Do you see their efforts as being as resonant in this? I mean, you were just talking about how there are people in Arborvitae who, you know, are clearly Democrats but clearly Walker supporters. Is there a resonant message from the way the Republicans won that we should expect to see in the this recall politicking and campaigning?
Well, I think Molly's point's important. The Democratic Party itself is either behind this thing or it's not. Uh-huh. And, you know, there needs to be some infrastructure for this recall campaign. But and this is a statewide race. I mean, if the recall elections were very much about these local individual districts, there is a statewide message about Scott Walker that has a lot of power for people. And so it really comes down to just doing the hard work, getting out the vote, getting that message out, being really clear about it, motivating people and getting them to the polls. So, you know, I think that's got to go on, regardless of setbacks like not getting to three seats. And
right.
So I certainly don't think it's impossible.
And is your sense that they'll actually move forward with this? Molly was saying there's question marks about their commitment to it at this point. And I'm sure this is all really fresh and there's a lot of examination that will happen over the next week or two and things may look a little bit different. But are we really going to get this recall campaign? Well, at least are we going to get a Democrat investment? I mean, we're going to get the campaign but is it going to be without the big political player involved?
I think it's going to be driven by, you know, the many, many activated citizens of Wisconsin who, you know, poured into Madison to resist Scott Walker. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you just look at the Klappenberg vote totals alone, there was, you know, twice as many votes for Klappenberg as we needed signatures on a recall petition to recall Scott Walker. So I think, you know, it's again, it's driven by the grassroots. I mean, I don't think in the state of Wisconsin, sitting around waiting for the Democratic Party leadership has really gotten us this far. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a grassroots driven campaign. I think they can absolutely collect the signatures. And, you know, the other thing is that the impact of these budget cuts is really going to settle in on people.
Yeah.
I mean, Walker continues to say that he's doing a great job and he's creating all these jobs. But, you know, schools are closing across the state already. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see some really tough situations, especially in the rural areas of the state where, you know, you can't do road repair anymore, where there's no money for maintaining municipal roads, where mm-hmm. the local school is closing. So, you know, I think it's going to be a tough time, but I think all the issues are the same. And I think that voters and, you know, just grassroots activists are motivated.
256-2001, 866-899-9678. If you're outside of the immediate Madison area and you want to join today's discussion, we're talking with Ruth Conniff from the Progressive Magazine and Molly Stentz, news facilitator here at WORT. They've been following the events here very closely, and we're talking about, of course, the elections last night, the recall elections for the six GOP state senators, and the results were... You know, we only got two of them when we needed three, so we came up a little bit short. We'll be taking your calls and talking about what all of this means for the recall of Scott Walker and trying to roll back and return Wisconsin to the great state that it has been over time. At the national level, you know, I think there's a lot of upset about the fact that when people were on the streets and marching and really active in January and February, that the White House and the national level Democratic Party was very absent and very quiet. And there's a lot of capital there that they could spend and they could get in on this. And why isn't that happening? Is it just because the Dems are Dems and they just are too afraid of picking a fight?
I don't think the National Democratic Party, I think that they have their view of this, which is that they don't want energy sucked away from the Obama campaign by something like Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why you saw Organize for America told by somebody inside the White House to take down Wisconsin-related material during that February period. Time period. However, you know, they did get involved in the recall campaign. Organize for America did push these recalls. And I think what is going to happen actually is an effort to glom on to the energy at the grassroots level in Wisconsin and siphon that into an Obama reelection bid,
sure.
Which I have to say is a very, very long reach politically.
Yeah.
You know, it is not the same thing.
No.
And the same things are not at stake for us as citizens of this state and this country. But
yeah. And, you know, I think the jury's kind of out on whether people wanted Obama here. When the Wisconsin 14 held a press conference upon their return back mm-hmm. to Madison, you know, a number of people, actually Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Was here and asked that very question, you know, where was Obama? Why wasn't he here? And, you know, a lot of the Democrats said, actually, we don't think his presence would be helpful. I mean, they said that at the time. They thought that he's an incredibly polarizing figure mm-hmm. that would probably drive out some of the moderate votes that they were hoping to get. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of people definitely were clamoring for influence or support nationally and mm-hmm. wanting to see, you know, a strong leader come out in support of union rights, something he campaigned on. And that was a disappointment to a lot of people.
That's
but
right. That's right.
But as far as, you know, whether his political capital was going to hurt or help the cause, I think
just not clear.
People were not in agreement on that. And in fact, you know, he's doing a flyover visit next week and not coming to Wisconsin. He's hitting Minnesota and I believe Illinois and Indiana on a Midwest trip, and no stops, no planned campaign stops in Wisconsin.
Well, we have. Oh, let me.
Okay.
Yep. Sorry. Let's go to the phones. We do have people lining up to join the conversation. So, hello, and welcome to Public Affair.
Hello.
Hello, that's you.
Yes, hi. See, I wanted some discussion about the strategy that the Democrats used in throughout the state here on these recall elections. It seemed to me that there was that they made some kind of an error, strategic error, in not capitalizing on the collective bargaining angst, and by spreading it around through all the other issues that of lack of money in the state. I think was wrong, and they should have capitalized, I believe, on the just the discouragement that was shown because of bargaining being attacked in the public sector and the consequent rollover into the private sector. Not to mention those of us that aren't union people, that were just disappointed in the historical rollover that our grandfathers struggled to obtain for us.
Excellent.
I think that was really bad.
I think you're right. So strategy.
And just to say from the ad perspective, I actually sat down and reviewed a number of the ads. I have tried to avoid them, but I did actually do my due diligence and watch the ads on purpose. I think the only person in Wisconsin to do that, but I did. And the thing you didn't hear mentioned in any of the ads being run by even We Are Wisconsin or Greater Wisconsin Committee, any of the liberal groups, the union groups, the progressive groups, union. That word was not in the ads. They did not focus on collective bargaining. They did not talk about union rights. They talked about the budget. They talked about budget cuts. They talked about education. They talked about environmental rollbacks. They talked about social issues. But yet you heard all the candidates talk about it. You heard Alberta Darling mention that right off the bat last night, saying this was a fight about unions. This was a fight about getting the state budget under control, and we knew that basically the unions were the standing in our way, and so that's why we did this. I mean, they're not dancing around the issue here.
Right.
They're calling it the way that they see it. But the ads try to take the discussion in a different level and dance around it. And I think, you know, a lot of the voters I spoke with at various precincts in Baraboo and then also in Milwaukee mentioned it, that was what was either bringing them to the poll to vote for their candidate or for, you know,
the
incumbent.
Is it the or one of the motivating factors?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and yet the Democratic strategy was to not really mention that. So it seems. We do have another caller waiting to join the program, so we'll go to the phones. Hello, and welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi. I had a comment about strategy, too. Senator Mark Hatfield from Oregon died this week. He was a liberal Republican who was openly opposed after a while to the Vietnam War and, you know, other ventures. Senator Jacob Javits of New York was a liberal Republican. Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine was a fairly liberal Republican. There used to be a lot of these people, and I think we need some investigation into why we assume that the election means everything, because aside from Dale Schultz, every single Republican has been in lockstep with the ALEC agenda, and Scott Walker is very willing to, in return for the power he's promised, I guess, is very willing to be their pawn.
Mm-hmm.
But this wasn't always the case in Wisconsin. Senator Proxmire, a Democrat, did a lot of legwork, and I think he spent about $100 each campaign. So I think we need to investigate exactly what kinds of threats are being made to members of the Republican Party in legislatures and Congress all over the country, in return for a promise of billions of dollars, you know, in total, to get some power and to do the bidding of groups like ALEC and the Bradley Foundation and the Chamber of Commerce and the Koch brothers, you know, all these other billionaires and billionaire groups that are basically acting as, you know, as taskmasters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that we're seeing that more clearly than ever now. I mean, it's been true for a long time that ALEC is writing state level legislation, and that we're seeing the actual, now that ALEC Exposed website came out thanks to a leak of ALEC documents to the Center for Media and Democracy, we can actually look at what's drafted by ALEC and how it's identical to legislation that's being passed in our state. That has been true in previous years, but we haven't been able to see it quite as clearly and boldly And actually, I was talking to Mark Pocan, our state representative here in Madison, who went for the Progressive Magazine to cover the ALEC conference and just got back a couple of days ago. And he described a situation in which there was a bill. ALEC has a corporate and a legislative body that vote on its bills that it creates, its model legislation that then it then had hands out to state houses around the country. The legislators on one particular bill wanted to soften the blow. I've forgotten what the exact issue was, but it was making this kind of neoliberal reform less brutal for localities. And the corporate board said, no, we're going to go with the full frontal assault. So the corporate membership of the board basically vetoed what the state legislators wanted, and that's the model legislation that's
that goes
going
out to...
Yeah, so you couldn't have a more just obvious example of the complete subversion of our democracy by corporate interests. Corporations are actually voting on this legislation, overruling the representatives of the voters and sending it on to be passed in the states. It's really, you have a feeling of just living in a complete sham democracy.
I think that's an interesting place for this conversation to go to, because it does speak to people's understanding of democracy, a sort of assumption that democracy is happening, and what democracy means. But we also have a caller, so we'll go to the phones. Hello, and welcome to A Public Affair.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I wanted to make a couple comments. First, the Democrats got their butts beat, and they did it because, like I had heard before, not the whole conversation, is because they didn't say it was about workers' rights. That's one of the things. The second thing is the Democratic Party of Wisconsin didn't really put any force behind it, including force from the national level. And the and Obama's going to get beat anyhow in this time, so I don't know why he doesn't resign. But the other thing I think that's important to realize is we don't have a democracy. This idea that this voter registration and everything else is coming up, we don't have a democracy. And I know yesterday on the program there were some of these people that were, and I can't remember the name of the organization, but was going to see that the ballots were run properly and so forth. Now, I haven't heard any report from them where they thought there were problems in certain areas. I know in Butler there was, because they wouldn't let those people who were outside the polls talk to the voters after they returned. They had them arrested or something. And so I would like you to comment on that. But I think people don't realize. You say they're turned off. Why are they turned off? Because they get all this crap, and they think, okay, it must be the Democrats. It's always the Democrats. It's always the poor. It's always those that don't have anything. And so I'll hang up and listen to your response. And thank you for the program.
Thanks for the call.
I mean, I think there's no question that our democracy is completely under assault in this state, and it's discouraging. But I don't think that it makes sense to give up on it altogether. I mean, we do have these little levers, and we need to do what we can to use those, because what's our alternative, you know? I mean, we really need to fight for having a functioning civil society, and we're up against a really overwhelming power. You know, just the volume of money and the brazenness on the other side is pretty overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But you know, we can go to the polls. We can. There are citizens groups that did poll watching yesterday. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can cast our votes, and we can get our message out. And I think even just getting out and talking to voters and realizing how much people are able to be swayed is an encouraging sign. I mean, people have two jobs. You know, they're struggling in a difficult economy, and they're not paying 100% attention to this stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, there is a lot at stake. I think on the union issue, you know, that's a political calculation based on the decline in union membership in our country. I mean, the, you know, private sector unions have just been decimated. So the public employee unions are sort of the last stand of the labor movement. And here in Madison, we are all either members of, related to members of, or close friends with members of public employee unions. So it's not, you know, my family's taken a big hit because of Scott Walker.
Right.
You know, probably most people that I see walking down the street in Madison are in the same boat. If you go up north, you're talking about it on a slightly more esoteric level, because you're talking to folks who own little, you know, tourist businesses. They're not union. Their employees are not union. Mm-hmm. And so even still, I think people get the idea that it's just fundamentally wrong to disempower employees, to say that they can't even sit down and talk to their employers about employment issues, which is the way that Jim Holprin puts it. Mm-hmm. And he went to Illinois, much to the dismay of even some of his own Democratic constituents. And he continues to make that point because he does feel that it has some traction as just as a basic issue of justice mm-hmm. with people. But the sad reality is the Democrats calculate that they're not running ads using labor organizing and unions as their main push because labor, you know, the rate of union membership has declined so much that that doesn't hit home the way it used to.
It's true, but it is one of those things that clearly, you know, it's a really short, simple message. When you start talking pro-union, you can make a number of assumptions about a candidate that, you know, that are probably accurate. And so it becomes valuable just as a sort of a touchstone for people to access, okay, this candidate does represent what I believe in, even though they're using maybe what's becoming an antiquated term or an antiquated reality.
Well, and on the flip side, you can predict people's voting patterns by union membership. And if people are members of unions, they tend to have more progressive positions on a variety of other issues. Mm-hmm. So there's an argument for union membership and for a drive to organize people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really where we have to start. But I don't think you can go then, you know, a step further and say, well, you know, how can politicians who are running for office in these local districts not talk union membership? Well, because there aren't any freaking union members right. in their district. You know, I mean, that's the one person I talked to when I was up in Arborvita at the Fireman's Picnic who really put the whole thing together and said, this is about, you know, Scott Walker, and this is about, you know, just the crushing of the middle class in our state, was a retired Teamster from Illinois. He drove a truck in Chicago for 9 years, and he was an officer in his local, and he retired up north. Well, he, you know, he had the big picture idea of what labor mm-hmm. means. Mm-hmm. Most of the other folks I talked to did not have that. They had bits and pieces. They are not members of the labor movement, and mm-hmm. they're not members of any movement, really. But, you know, they say things like, one guy I talked to said, well, I can understand sticking up for teachers, but he shouldn't have walked out on his job, and so he's going to vote to recall Holprin. You know, they got part of the message. That's why I say, you know, you start talking to people and you can't just give up. You think there's a lot of work to be done here. Uh-huh. It's not just the ads. It's not just the money. It's not just, you know, Alec writing our legislation, which are granted huge problems. But, you know, getting a message out to people and talking to people about what it means to be part of a movement and have a progressive politics is that's work that's being done in our state now. And I think it's actually energizing for folks to be doing it.
Well, and this is movement building, too.
Yeah.
We do have a caller waiting to join the program, so we'll go to the phones. Hello, and welcome to Public Affair.
Hi there. Is it me?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to have this show so we can discuss, because I think it's an important time for reflection and kind of regrouping. I think there's a lot of lessons we can learn out of this. And if you kind of look at the electoral arena as kind of a way of democratic expression, you know, there's a lot of clear limitations to it where, for example, as we're, you know, the guests were talking about, the way the campaigns were run by the Democratic Party and the union bureaucracy, where they were afraid to actually talk about the issues that people care about, and that's because they were trying to triangulate to win the votes of independents. That I read a good article that talked about how people on both sides, for and against unions, have their minds made up. And so the electoral arena was set to basically, you know, winning over the independents. But I don't see that as really democracy, you know, where you're ignoring the issues. I see the protests out on the streets as a real form of democracy. And also I feel that there's a fundamental limitation in having someone elected to represent you instead of you representing yourself. I think that there is an alternative, much deeper form of democracy that we've seen in upsurges where in our country's history, where people organize around their interests to represent themselves through organizations where they have common interests. And it becomes more and more clear through this kind of outlet that where the majority lies of, you know, working class interests, of being against sexism and other forms of oppression. And I think that we have to begin to question the electoral process as a form of really full democracy and really look to history for much better examples of where, you know, for months, we had the whole country, the whole state coming out, thousands of people coming out in support of us, and still we didn't win. And I think it's because we missed strategies that were used in the past. For example, union rights in the first place weren't voted, you know, into being. It was huge strikes, huge protests, and even then, FDR, the way I understand history, he was collaborating to basically form business company-run unions rather than worker-run unions. And basically the workers co-opted this plan that he was collaborating with businesses on, and they went on to ignore what he was trying to do and represented themselves. So basically my point is that we shouldn't rely on anyone to represent us except ourselves. We shouldn't allow union bureaucrats, and we shouldn't allow any politicians, no matter what pleasant things they say to our faces. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, we're stuck with a certain system that we have that is representative. And
I think what the caller said, though, about the rank and file getting out ahead of the leadership really is absolutely demonstrably true here in Wisconsin. It was not the union leadership that led people out into the streets, with the exception of John Matthews, who saw an opportunity and grabbed it. You know, that was rank and file driven. And union leadership here was scrambling around trying to figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is not the 1930s, and they are not accustomed to this these battle conditions. You know, I mean, there's been this slow attrition over many, many years. And, you know, there is not the sense of proactive urgency from the leadership of labor unions that there was at that time. We may be going back to that time. It's a scary prospect. I mean, we're looking at, you know, potentially very harsh conditions. Who would have thought that the state legislature would be bringing back child labor in this session? You know, I mean, we're looking at some, you know, fundamental battles that in a lot of ways we grew up feeling had been fought and won already the labor movement in this country. We're back down to the grassroots level fighting those battles again. And so I think that the caller is absolutely right about that. You know, the Democratic Party leadership in the state of Wisconsin is not going to lead the charge against Scott Walker. As Molly pointed out, we are going forward with this recall effort. They're being a little waffly about whether they're leading it. They're kicking it to the grassroots. And it's really, you know, when you look at history and you look at what drove Democrats in the past to hitch their star to the labor movement, it was this tremendous sense that they had better run to the front of this parade because people were activated. And that is what is going to have to happen here. And I think it can happen, and it will happen. People have a lot at stake personally. This is an unprecedented assault on civil society that we're living through. We are on the front lines here in Wisconsin of, you know, this sense of just completely doing away with a social compact that says that kids ought to be able to get a good public education, that we ought to have a reasonable environment, that we ought to maintain our basic infrastructure, and that we can aspire to have a middle class and a middle class life, you know, in this country. And I think that hits home for the majority of us, you know, who are not, you know, the Koch brothers. So I think we have no choice. You know, we are going to fight back.
Well, and a lot of those victories from 60, 70, 100 years ago were born of pain.
Yeah.
People were experiencing firsthand a lot of pain and misery, and that's a very powerful motivator. And you know, as a product of the middle class and as a member of the middle class, I know that pain is out there, but I don't have it as a part of my personal history, as my childhood. And so that's this weird thing where you get all these victories that can develop a middle class, and then, you know, the middle class sort of doesn't have the understanding of why those victories are so important, and that's what we're facing now. And we do have a caller, so we'll go to the phones. Hello, you're on the air with Ruth Conniff.
Yeah, hello, Senor Luna.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, this is my comment about all this. I think it was correctly mentioned that there's a problem because of the absence of the unions in the popular perspective, because we have to face it that in the private sector, labor unions are virtually extinct. So you can hardly expect a general public that has no contact with the union movement to really show much interest in the concept of organizing, because even the unions have shown so little interest in doing any more organizing. The only place where the unions are to any significant extent is the public sector, and given that situation, I think it's going to be very hard for people to show much sympathy towards unions or the union movement until they see how they can benefit from them, too, and they can't right now. My other comment is similar to what John Nichols quoted Alberta Darling at the pep rally for the recall vote. He mentioned that someone like Alberta Darling had said, well, what's the problem? Everything looks great. Everything's going well for us. And the unfortunate fact is she was absolutely right. If you live in River Hills, where there's a minimum 5-acre residential zoning requirement and probably not a single house below $1 million, if you're able to live there, things are going probably extremely well for you, and they have every appearance that they'll get better as long as you're on that economic level. And that's another thing that something has to be done about. We have to do something to level the economic playing field so there aren't these extremes and there aren't these people that benefit from an economy that lets them live in seven-figure houses while other people are going homeless. And I think I've made my point, so I'll just take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time to see how long can we continue to have this peculiar consciousness in our society where if you aren't living in our Alberta Darling's neighborhood and you are just a regular middle-class person, but you're in the private sector and you're not in a union and you don't have good benefits and you're feeling really insecure, do you blame teachers because they have slightly better
because they
know,
get
working
the summer
conditions
off.
And,
right.
Right. I mean, that is what the Republicans have done so effectively, is that not only have they got, you know, the rich people on their side, but they have managed to successfully make this race to the bottom argument so that, you know, in that preposterous fireside chat that our governor gave when he talked about his caterer brother-in-law who has to pay $800 for his health insurance, you know, his argument was fundamentally, look, a lot of you folks don't have good benefits, and so nobody should have
exactly.
good benefits.
Right.
And I mean,
right.
this is, you know, to me, not a winning argument. I mean, hopefully people aspire to have those benefits themselves and to organize. And, you know, I love the sign at one of the rallies that said, don't like your benefits, join a union. You know, I mean, the idea that we could have a decent standard across our society, which we can well afford, mm-hmm. I think should be a winning argument. And the Republicans for a long time have been able to divide people against each other with that invidious race to the bottom rhetoric. But I sort of feel like it's reached a new low in Wisconsin, where they're really coming out publicly and making statements like that, like Scott Walker's example of his caterer brother-in-law, you know. I really think that there's fertile ground there for pushing back.
Well, so do you think they've bottomed out? Do you think that it's that there is that the case they make can only last so long, and it's just not going to resonate with people anymore, or are they just going to pivot to something new that energizes people that will still get them votes no matter what it is, so they can push their agenda forward?
Well, I mean, I don't underestimate their ability to make these clever arguments. I mean, even the argument about the 14 walking off the job and that they got paid when they weren't doing their job and you don't get paid when you're not doing your job, you know, I wouldn't have guessed that that would get traction, because to me it was so transparently ridiculous. It did. It has. Yeah. It's driving these two, you know, elections we're going to see next week. We'll see what happens there. We'll mm-hmm. see how much it resonates with people. But, you know, at some point, people are pretty invested in their own personal economic conditions, and we're in a tough time. And I think, you know, you can only make the argument for so long that, you know, your neighbor should be as badly off as you are before you start thinking, you know, a little bit more about your own situation. So, you know, I don't know if they can go lower. I don't know if they, I think, you know, things are going to get a little bit worse in Wisconsin before mm-hmm. they get better, just because of this budget,
yeah,
you know, and because of the political leadership that we have. But I do think that at some point, people are concerned about their own economic interests. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just can't pull the wool over their eyes forever about that.
My neighbors just either last night or today had a baby, their first baby, and they're having a conversation between themselves about whether or not they want to stay in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And they're both from Wisconsin. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know where you go, but
Vermont is going to have a huge population spike.
Look out, Vermont. Well, we do have one caller. I'll ask the caller to be brief because there's not much time left in the show. So hello, and you're on the air.
Hello. Just a reminder from Tom Hartman, I think it was, that corporations are like royalty, and ALEC is like their union.
Sure.
And organizing for a union is the closest thing to real democracy that we have.
All right. Okay. Well, that's a, I think that's a good direction to take the end of the show into. Ruth, any final comments?
Well, I think that's right. I think, you know, that there are a whole bunch of things that need to get done in terms of organizing people. But I guess my final comment is just that, you know, it makes sense to be realistic and not to kid yourself. You know, this recall election was not the big boost that the progressives were looking for, certainly not that Democrats were looking for. However, you know, the Republicans lost two seats, you know, two historically very Republican districts turned their backs on the Republican Party. And there is still a lot of energy and a lot of momentum. And I think that, you know, this is what we need to do. We need to keep working to, you know, to support what's decent in our state and to say no to the corporate takeover of our and the trashing of our civil society.
It is a long haul. It would be nice to get a victory every now and then.
It's a long, hard fight, but we're, you know, we're going on.
Well, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate you taking the hour out to talk about this and take calls. Thanks to Grania for engineering, and thanks for listening, and keep listening.